Civilians are being evacuated to Russia from eastern Ukraine's self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic as tensions escalated the rest of the region. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urges Arab and Muslim nations to defend the occupied city of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israel's aggression. Plus, Iran urges the European side in the Vienna talks to consider Tehran's red lines and avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The situation remains tense in eastern Ukraine amid renewed fighting between government troops and pro-Russia forces. The Ukraine's military says pro-Russia forces have opened fire on more than 20 settlements and killed a soldier. Explosions have also been reported north of Donetsk City. A second exploded shell has been found on Russian territory near the Ukraine border. A leader of pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine has ordered a full troop mobilization over fears of an offensive.
We should unite all our efforts. I call on my fellow countrymen, reservists, to report to mobilization officers. Today I have signed a decree on general mobilization. I call on all men in the Republic able to hold a weapon in their hands to stand up to protect your families, your children, wives and mothers. Together we will achieve the desired and necessary victory for us all. We will protect Donbass and all Russian people.
Pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine are continuing to evacuate residents of Donetsk and the surrounding areas as several buses were seen leaving for Russia. The situation escalated a few days ago when both sides accused each other of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concerns over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. Moscow also denies Western accusations that it is planning an invasion of Ukraine. The U.S. official says more than 40% of Russian forces on the Ukraine border are in an attack position, and Moscow has begun a campaign of destabilization. Meanwhile, the U.S. has threatened Russia with what it calls unprecedented economic costs if it invades Ukraine.
And let me be clear. I can say with absolute certainty, if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States, together with our allies and partners, will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs. We have worked intensively with many of you in this room to ensure we are prepared to move forward with consequences. We have prepared together economic measures that will be swift, severe, and united.
Harris made the announcement on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. She added that the U.S. will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries. The U.S. VP said, however, Washington will not stop with economic measures. The U.S. and its allies will also reinforce natural allies in Ukraine's eastern flank also. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the U.S. are on high alert. Jerome Hughes is a correspondent joining us from Brussels to tell us more about this. Well, we've heard the soundbites there from the VP of the U.S., which was severe in terms of the economic sanctions that potentially the U.S. may exercise. Tell us more about what has transpired in that Munich Security Conference in terms of Ukraine and, of course, new developments there, Jerome.
Well, Cave, it's more or less the same line that the West has been pushing in recent weeks since this sort of crisis escalated. And what basically the European Union, the United States, and the UK are saying is that Russia will effectively be cut off from the international financial system if there is an invasion of Ukraine. So, and it's that when we heard the debate being debated in the European Parliament, there were a sizable number of MEPs, members of the European Parliament, lawmakers, who were saying that this is just the wrong track to go down, that this constant anti-Russia rhetoric, which we've been seeing building up now for years and years, and these constant threats about the SWIFT system, which is, you know, effectively the international trading and currency system, to cut Russia off from SWIFT and so on, And it's the type of rhetoric that really has been unhelpful, according to many lawmakers. So we've seen an escalation in the threats. We've seen the likes of Joe Biden talking about making sure that the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project between Russia and Germany, that just will be scrapped if there's an invasion of Ukraine, which, of course, you know, for the US to come out and unilaterally say this and make this threat when he's standing beside Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, it just shows a lack of respect for actually the independence of Germany, because this is a private contract between Russia and Germany that has nothing to do with the EU and the US. So we've seen the build-up of the anti-Russia rhetoric. And when you listen to the European Parliament debate, which took place a few days ago, there was just calls from legislators to calm things down, stop pushing against Russia. 40% of the EU's gas comes from Russia. That is a massive amount of energy because, of course, we're here, 27 countries, a population of more than 400 million people. We already have a massive energy crisis. And so to keep building up this rhetoric instead of trying to calm things down, what Russia basically wants is for NATO, we have the majority of NATO members are also members of the European Union. The Russia wants NATO to say, look, we will stop provoking, we will stop putting vessels in the Black Sea, we will stop building up military bases in countries close to your country, we will ramp things down, Ukraine will not join NATO. You know, from Russia's perspective, just if you listen to impartial security analysts, they're saying it's perfectly legitimate for Russia to say that it does not want Ukraine to join NATO, because already NATO has broken previous agreements by advancing further eastwards in Europe. And yet, you know, if Ukraine was to join NATO, you could imagine that you would have these basically US bases right on Russia's borders. So it's a case of Russia wanting to protect its own integrity, its own security interests.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Jerome Hughes there from Brussels. Moving on, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is urging Arab and Muslim nations to shoulder their joint responsibility to defend the city of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israeli aggression. In a statement marking the World Quds Week, the movement says the occasion is the best opportunity to keep the Palestinian cause alive at an international level. Hamas says all political and media forums should be utilized to attain that end. The movement has praised the Palestinian nation's struggles to defend Al-Quds against Israeli atrocities, as well as acts of terror by settlers. The statement comes amid heightened tensions in an East Al-Quds neighborhood. Israel has been trying to evict Palestinians families forcibly from Sheikh Jarrah in favor of settlers. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Well, Hamas has made a statement urging Arab nations to unify and to shoulder their joint responsibilities, especially during this pivotal week. Has that received any audience? I mean, has there been any joint statements made of any kind as to what they may do?
Well, according to the statement of Hamas movement, the Hamas movement encourages an active attendance in such, let's say, events, important events, to support the legitimate rights of the Palestinians and to defend the Palestinian land, especially Jerusalem, Al-Quds, the Muslim sanctuaries, the holy places, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So there is a call for Arab and Muslim nations, as well as the Palestinian people living across the occupied territories, not to leave the people alone, to take part in every possible means in the activities of this international or World Quds Day, especially that this week comes at a time when the Israeli forces had deleted their aggression against the people of Sheikh Jarrah and the people of Al-Quds in general. The last week had witnessed numerous escalation, numerous aggression, with the clashes taking part between the Palestinians living in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and the Israeli settlers, as well as the Israeli soldiers. Dozens had been wounded. Others were arrested by the Israeli forces. All this comes because there is the Palestinian Saleh family is facing the imminent eviction from their home in March, because the Israeli court rejected all calls from this family and had decided that homes their home would be given to Israeli settlers. That's why Hamas movement is saying it's an opportunity for all Palestinians and the world to take part in the World Quds Week in order to support and to stand by the residents of Sheikh Jarrah and by the with the residents of Al-Quds in general.
And in terms of the World Quds Week, what are we to expect on that? Anything that's going to be happening there in the occupied territories to mark it?
Up till the moment, there is nothing had been declared, let's say, here in the occupied West Bank. But usually in the Gaza Strip, where the Hamas movement is, is there, their administration is there, could be taking part in a number of activities and events. But here in the occupied West Bank, up to the moment, nothing. Okay. There are no calls. Maybe in Al-Quds, sometimes we witness some demonstrations and protests. And of course, in the occupied West Bank, we can witness some protests and demonstrations
right.
to the area where the Israeli forces are stationed in order to express their rejection of the Israeli occupation and the illegal settlements.
Thank you so much for that, Mona Kandilva from Occupied Ramallah. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal continue the talks in the Austrian capital in an attempt to revive the accord. Tehran says the behavior of the U.S. and the European parties to the deal determines how long the negotiations will last. The Iranian foreign minister has also urged the European sides to embrace negotiating principles if they want the Vienna talks to yield results. Hossein Amir Abdollahian reiterated that Iran is determined to reach a good agreement as soon as possible. He made the remarks during a meeting with his Italian counterpart on the sidelines at the Munich Security Conference. The Iranian official also warned the European parties to the JCPOA against making any miscalculations. He urged them to consider Tehran's red lines and to avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations. Fouad Azadi, a professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, says the Europeans are spreading propaganda about the Vienna to get concessions from Iran.
As we get closer to the end of negotiations and JCPOA, you're going to see these type of tactics. The idea behind this particular tactic is that if you say that we are reaching an agreement, that puts pressure on the other side to accept your proposals, because the general feeling is that an agreement is very near. And that's a way of getting concessions from the other side. So that's one aspect of this story. The second aspect is called the blame game, which is designed to put the responsibility for the failure of the negotiations on the other side, saying that it was the demands that Iran made that resulted in not reaching an agreement. That's what they call them. They talk about the blame game. And that's another tactic that's going to be used.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has had other meetings on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference in Germany. He has discussed various issues, including the situation in Afghanistan, with the UN Chief Antonio Guterres. Amir Abdollahian and Guterres called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. The Iranian official said the formation of such a government that enjoys the participation of all political groups is essential for resolving the problems of the country. Amir Abdollahian also stressed the need for continued humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan. The country is facing a dire humanitarian situation as several Western countries have stopped giving it financial assistance in the wake of the Taliban takeover last August. A recent U.S. decision to seize half of Afghan frozen funds is expected to make the situation worse. Frahius is a Belfast-based author and journalist. He believes the war in Afghanistan was an imperialistic agenda and that the West has no humanitarian consideration for that country.
I think if America and the West had any humanitarian considerations whatsoever, they never would have instigated the war on terror, the war on the Muslim faith, and the war on Afghanistan. I think the destruction of Afghanistan is quite simply the imperialist capitalist cabal in Washington and in NATO, continuing the 19th century form of resource theft from countries that are vulnerable to Western white imperialist military superpowers. I think Iran should be congratulated. I think Iran has shown great patience. It has shown great observation to the human values and the sanctity of human life. I think it's very important that people realize that the West has no intention of coming to the aid of Afghanistan, and it should take other countries that are connected to the United Nations, and I would specifically encourage China to come to the aid of Afghanistan, because China is the complete polar opposite of American imperialism.
Mali's ruling military junta renews its calls for the immediate withdrawal of French troops from the African country.
In the light of repeated breaches of defense agreements, the Malian government asks French authorities to withdraw without delay Barkhane and Takuba forces from the national territory under the supervision of the Malian authorities.
The spokesman has questioned France's plan to pull out its forces over several months. He has also described as unsatisfactory the results of the French-led military engagement in the Sahel state for nearly 9 years. The French President Emmanuel Macron says Paris and its European and African allies would withdraw their troops from Mali in what he calls an orderly fashion. Macron rejects the criticism that France has failed in its former colony. Relations between the two countries have been strained since the 2020 coup in Mali. France deployed troops there in 2013 under the pretext of fighting terrorists, but the operations have failed to quell violence and has led to public discontent. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This money belongs to the people of Afghanistan, not to the United States, said an Afghan protest organizer in Kabul recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Curley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Love to Afghanistan Vigils to Demand Return of $7 Billion Stolen by U.S. Here's the details. With the people of Afghanistan facing one of the most severe humanitarian crises in the world, U.S.-based peace activists, who largely blame the policies of their own government for inflicting pain on millions of innocent Afghans, are demanding the Biden administration to return billions of dollars of seized assets to the war-torn country before more lasting harm and cruelty is done. Under the banner of Love to Afghanistan, nationwide actions were scheduled for the weekend and localized vigils organized set for other days by Peace Action, World Beyond War, and other humanitarian groups who argue that $7 billion frozen by the U.S. government and subsequently seized by an executive order issued recently by Joe Biden rightfully belongs to the Afghan people, who without it face an economy on the brink of collapse and a healthcare system and federal infrastructure without adequate support amid the COVID-19 pandemic and a worsening food crisis. Thus far, the vigils took place in Illinois, Kentucky, Maine, New York, and other states. According to a call to action by organizers, after 20 years of war in Afghanistan, Peace Action welcomed the withdrawal of troops from the country and an end to the war. Yet, when the United States military pulled out of Afghanistan, the Biden administration also responded by choking off assets to Afghan banks and the economy by freezing the reserves of the Afghan Central Bank held in the U.S. They also imposed sanctions on those doing business with Afghanistan and cut aid. Jobs and income disappeared, people cannot afford to buy food, and mass starvation is now occurring. Hunger could kill more now than in two decades of war. This humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan is, in the words of the International Red Cross, a human-made catastrophe. Human-made largely by coercive U.S. economic policies. In December, 46 members of Congress wrote a letter demanding the U.S. unfreeze assets that had been locked following the U.S. military withdrawal earlier in 2021. But instead of heeding that call, Biden took the step of more permanently seizing the funds that otherwise would be under control of Afghanistan's central bank. The Bank of Afghanistan, that is DAB, which now operates under the authority of the Taliban government. Biden's executive order includes setting aside half of the funds, $3.5 billion, for possible settlement claims by families who lost loved ones in 9/11 attacks of 2001. But critics have said the Afghan people who had nothing to do with the crimes of that day 20 years ago should not be punished for the acts of Al-Qaeda, most of them Saudis and Egyptians. Promoting the Love to Afghanistan events in the op-ed for Common Dreams last week, peace activist Jean Etty, coordinator of the Montgomery County Peace Action Group in Maryland, said the economic war against the Afghan people has the potential to be just as deadly as the 20 years of war and occupation they have just endured. Explaining the current situation and the liquidity crisis gripping the country, she wrote, "The government has almost no money and cannot pay workers who cannot buy food for their families. Most have received no payment for months. In addition, Afghans have limited access to their own funds in banks. International commerce has halted." Given U.S. sanctions and the liquidity crisis, even international humanitarian relief organizations have great difficulty operating in Afghanistan, despite U.S. government assurances. Relief efforts designed to stave off starvation, although critically important right now, cannot endure for long since no one is willing to provide assistance indefinitely to a country of almost 40 million people. The country needs a functioning government and economy and needs access to the international financial system. Political backbone is now required of the Biden administration, argued Eti, who said the president should not be scared of predictable GOP attacks or media hit pieces about somehow appeasing the Taliban by giving the everyday people back money, the money that rightfully belongs to them. The lives of 1 million children are more important than a negative headline in a tabloid. The U.S. should unfreeze Afghan government assets and lift sanctions hindering the recovery of the Afghan economy and humanitarian relief efforts. We must end the U.S. economic war on Afghanistan. Recently, the Dao Bank of Afghanistan demanded the funds ostensibly stolen by the U.S. government be returned and called the move by Biden an injustice against the people of Afghanistan. Also, recently, protests in Kabul decried the theft of the money. This money belongs to the people of Afghanistan, not to the United States. This is the right of Afghans, Abdulrahman, a civil society activist and the demonstrations organizer, told the Dawn newspaper. Spokesperson for the Taliban government, Mohammad Naim, also decried the move in a post on social media, saying the theft and seizure of money held by the United States of the Afghan people represents the lowest level of human and moral decay of a country and a nation. Naim tweeted, added that, while victory and defeat are evident throughout history, the greatest and most shameful defeat is when moral defeat combines with military defeat.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanu al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at justice being a pillar, or at least one of the pillars and foundations of a human rights. And the champion of this pillar of justice is none other than the commander of the faithful Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. We have been speaking about Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam and his stand when it comes to justice and creating a sense of human rights in his community and trying to get people to abide by these rights. Now, among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi concentrated on during his life, the fact that when he looked at leadership or government or governance or khilafat or caliphate, as we call it, he gave it a different definition. He gave it a different meaning. To the majority, if not all the rulers and kings and what have you, being a king or being in power, it means that you are the king and people have to serve you. And since you are in power, then everything belongs to you. And we can see the trend still continues until today. And thus, because of this ideology and that mindset, the rights of people gets taken and people lose their human rights. And sometimes they lose their basic human rights. In the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, rulership or khilafat does not mean that the ruler should sit on the throne of dignity, strengthen his power, and make his position as a mean of enslaving the people. Amir al-Mu'mineen, on the contrary, he said that if you are in power, then you become the servant of people. Because when people gave you this position or this power to lead and rule them, they gave you that based on the notion that you need to serve them. And we can see the same thing today in our election campaigns, that people who put themselves for election, you'll find they give promises long and wide of things they will do to better the lives of people, things they will change to make your life heaven, and so on and so forth. And most of us, because we are gullible, sometimes we have no other choice, we believe these people. Once they take power, though, all these promises goes to thin air, and the only thing that gets served is themselves. They just work themselves for themselves, and they make people do their work for them, and they just get richer themselves. Their families get richer, their friends get richer, and everyone else is losers. So this is how it works. However, Amir al-Mu'mineen says no. When it comes to justice, you have to give people their rights and you become their servant. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. And we are still talking about justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. That Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he looks at power and he looks at taking position, even he himself, he was appointed by Allah as the commander of the faithful, as the leader of mankind, after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa'ala. Such a lofty position. A position that sadly was taken from him, and the course of Islam was diverted. Rather, the course of humanity was diverted. We are suffering what we are suffering because the right person was not put into his position. Now, even that being taken from him, he said, I don't mind. As long as I maintain my role in keeping peace, in keeping the Muslim nation going smoothly, if I have to give my power away, give my position away, but I can maintain and I can help people, then I have achieved my goal. When people came to him after the death of the third Khalifa, he refused. He said, I have no need to rule you. What's the point of me ruling you? I'm not seeking power. I'm not seeking wealth. I'm not seeking fame like the ones before me or those who will come after me. I'm very well off. I'm much better. I got less responsibilities. But when they forced him into it, he said, sure, I can lead. I can rule you, but under one condition, that I apply justice. And to a lot of people during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and even critics until our day today, they looked at Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam as a person who was harsh, as a person who did not, you know, do things the right way. And sadly, such ideology mentality still continues. They do not realize that when Amir al-Mu'mineen said, I want to apply justice, and I want to enjoin good and forbid evil and go on the tradition of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, he was simply saying to them, I will put myself at your service to make sure that every one of you gets his right. I'm not going to create a division or create this level and classes in society where I would glorify some classes because of their lineage, because of their tribe, and I will give others extra because they're close to me and neglect the rest. He said, no, to me, you all will be equal. And with such concept, it did not go very well with a lot of the people at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, because they were arrogant, they were ignorant, they were, as we call them, pagan worshippers. They lived a mentality and a mindset of superiority. I have to be higher and better than the people. So under the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that did not exist. So they had to oppose him, they had to fight him, they had to wage wars against him. So for the 4 years and 6 months he was in power, he was constantly trying to battle these people who were raging wars against him, only because he wanted to give people their rights and establish justice. This is Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. Inshallah, we'll leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The long-term effects of having COVID are still being discovered, and among them is an increased chance of being diagnosed with mental health disorders. We're prepared for you an article written by Melody Schreiber. The piece is titled Study Finds COVID Infection Increases Risk of Mental Health Disorders. According to new research looking at millions of health records in the United States over the course of a year, having COVID-19 puts people at a significantly increased chance of developing new mental health conditions, potentially adding to existing crises of suicide and overdoses. The long-term effects of having COVID are still being discovered, and among them is an increased chance of being diagnosed with mental health disorders. They include depression, anxiety, stress, and an increased risk of substance use disorders, cognitive decline, and sleep problems. A marked difference from others who also endured the stress of the pandemic but weren't diagnosed with the virus. Ziad Al-Ali, Chief of Research and Development at the VA St. Louis Healthcare System and senior author of the paper, said, "This is basically telling us that millions and millions of people in the United States infected with COVID are developing mental health problems. That makes us a nation in distress." He said the higher risk of mental health disorders, including suicidal ideas and opioid use, is particularly concerning. Ziad Al-Ali added, "This is really almost a perfect storm that is brewing in front of our eyes. For another opioid epidemic 2 or 3 years down the road, for another suicide crisis 2 or 3 years down the road." James Jackson, director of behavioral health at Vanderbilt University's ICU Recovery Center, who was not involved with this study, said, "These unfolding crises are quite a big concern." He's also seeing patients whose previous conditions, including anxiety, depression, and opioid use disorder, worsened during the pandemic. The experts said research like this shows the clear need to follow patients in the weeks and months after even mild COVID diagnosis, and to seek quick treatment for any emerging disorders. Ziad Al-Ali said, "If we apply attention to it now and nip it in the bud, we could literally save lives." According to the study published on Wednesday, 16th of February, more than 18% of COVID patients developed mental health problems, compared with 12% of those who did not have COVID. The study followed more than 153,000 patients who tested positive for COVID in the Veterans Affairs Health System between March of 2020 and January of 2021, and compared them with other health records. To 5.8 million people who did not test positive in that time, but lived through the same stresses of the pandemic, and with 5.6 million patients seen before the pandemic. Among all the patients who developed new mental health problems during the pandemic, the COVID patients were significantly more likely to develop cognitive problems, 80%, sleep disorders, 41%, depression, 39%, stress problems, 38%, anxiety, 35%, and opioid use disorder, 34%, compared with those who didn't have COVID. The study looked only at patients with no history of mental health diagnosis in the past 2 years. It compared those hospitalized for COVID versus other illnesses and compared outcomes to thousands of flu cases. The study also adjusted for factors like demographics, other health conditions, and other factors. The results were all clear. COVID has a marked effect on mental health. Those with more severe cases of COVID, especially those who need to be hospitalized, tend to be at higher risk. But even those with mild or asymptomatic cases were more likely to receive mental health diagnoses. Ziad Al-Ali said, people who were hospitalized had it worse, but the risk in non-hospitalized patients is significant and absolutely not trivial. And that represents the majority of people in the United States and the world. The study did have some limitations. Most of those analyzed were older white men. But controlling for race, gender and age found no changes in risk. Other studies have shown the coronavirus can be found in the brain. Ziad Al-Ali said, we can actually see the virus in the amygdala, in the hippocampus, the very center responsible for regulating our moods, regulating our emotions. Jackson said the study adds to other research showing that mental health issues are a huge concern after COVID, and the results line up with what he sees among patients. Jackson said, we're learning that COVID may be even more problematic and more impactful than we thought. The experts said early treatment of patients facing new or additional mental health challenges after COVID can make a crucial difference. Ziad Al-Ali said, the idea here is to identify patients' data early to hopefully reduce this from becoming a much larger problem down the road. If you leave a disease unattended, it only gets worse. But the longer the virus continues circulating, the more long-term problems it may create, adding even greater pressure to health systems. Ziad Al-Ali said, the wave of people with mental health disorders is going to be hitting the clinics in the next year or two or even three as a result of COVID and as a result of the pandemic. And many mental health practitioners don't accept insurance, creating a large stumbling block for patients, while others have long waiting lists. James Jackson, director of behavioral health at Vanderbilt University, said, this is a gigantic problem and I'm not really sure what we're going to do about it. The needs are vastly greater than the resources. James Jackson has set up peer support groups to offer counseling to patients dealing with long COVID. Brain fog, cognitive impairment, memory problems, feelings of inadequacy. The groups are held on Zoom so patients can join from all over the country. Ziad Al-Ali said, we need to pay attention to the long-term consequences of COVID, adding, if we only pay attention to the short-term consequences, the first 30 days or the first 90 days, we really, really are missing the larger picture. Al-Ali said, the pandemic itself caught the United States unprepared, and we're going to be caught unprepared again for long COVID. He added, the reality is that COVID is producing long-term consequences, and we cannot just wish it away or sweep it under the rug or not deal with it. Moreover, researchers have found cases of anxiety and depression around the world have increased dramatically in 2021, with an estimated 76 million extra cases of anxiety and 53 million extra cases of major depressive disorder that would have been expected had COVID not stuck. The study is the latest to suggest the pandemic has taken a serious toll on mental health and that women and young people are more likely to be affected than men or older people. The lead author of the new study, Dr. Damien Santomaro of University of Queensland in Australia, said, we believe that is because women are more likely to be affected by the social and economic consequences of the pandemic. He said, women are more likely to take on additional carer and household responsibilities due to school closures or family members becoming unwell. Women also tend to have lower salaries, less savings, and less secure employment than men, and so are more likely to be financially disadvantaged during the pandemic. Adding, a rise in domestic violence may also play a role. Young people have also been faced with a series of challenges. Dr. Damian Santomaro said, youth have been impacted by the closures of schools and higher education facilities and wider restrictions inhibiting young people from peer interactions, adding that young people were also more likely to become unemployed after an economic crisis. Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
And every day, every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful hadith and tradition which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding prostration or sujood. We have many traditions regarding the virtue of prostration and sajda in which have been narrated from our infallible Imams and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. All of these traditions seem to indicate and allude to the something similar, and that is that prostration is a state in which man can achieve the highest degree of proximity and qurb to Allah Ta'ala. In this tradition that we're going to be reciting for you and reading for you today, the Imam, basing himself upon this truth and this verity, the Imam makes a recommendation to one of his companions. So it's almost as if this companion wanted to ask, what is this state in which I am closest to Allah? Tell me this so that I know in which state I should pray. Obviously, when man achieves a high degree of proximity to God, that's the time when a person should ask and request Allah for something. Right? I mean, there's more chances of the person's request and prayer being answered at that time. So this person asks the Imam regarding this. Let's see what the Imam says. Imam Sadiq was once asked by Sa'id ibn Yasar, one of his companions, whether he should supplicate in the state of prostration or in the state of bowing. To which he, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, replied in the following manner, supplicate while prostrating. For verily, the nearest the servant can ever be to Allah is in the state of prostration. So supplicate for your worldly needs as well as for your life in the hereafter. In a similar tradition from Imam Sadiq is narrated, has been reported to have said, prostration is the highest degree of worship that man can perform. And Imam Ali alayhi salam also said, nothing can bring about proximity to Allah, glory be to him, except an abundance of prostration and bowing. So in this last tradition, we see that Imam Ali mentions two things, ruku, bowing, and sajda or prostration. These two are states in which man is in an extreme state of proximity and closeness to God. But out of these two states, prostration brings about a further state of proximity to God, as we've narrated from the tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Obviously, this qurb is not a physical qurb or proximity. It's a spiritual qurb or proximity, because we know that, first of all, God is not a physical being, so he's not physically close or distant from us. At the same time, we know that God Almighty is always near to us. So when we say that we become closer to God, what it really means is that we become aware of the fact that God is already proximate and close to us. And the highest degree in which this can be achieved is in the state of prostration. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at prostration in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.